Case number 23-7169, Marseille Clinic and AG, versus Republic of the Chocorn of the Atlantic. Mr. Havelik for the appellant, Mr. Schmidt for the appellee.
Mr. Havelik, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. Malik Havelik for the appellant, the Republic of Equatorial Guinea. We are asking this court respectfully to take a close second look at a dispute resolution clause in a management contract that was entered into between the parties. And we submit that when the court does so, it will appreciate that the arbitral tribunal below erroneously exercised arbitral jurisdiction over breach of contract disputes that the sovereign did not agree to submit to arbitration. And for that reason, we request that the award not be recognized and confirmed under Article 5.1c of the New York Convention, because it deals with a difference not contemplated by or not following within the terms of the submission to arbitration. So to jump into the meaning of this dispute resolution clause, I'd like to make one preambular
comment. Just before you get to the meaning, you have to get over a threshold question of whether this dispute was committed to the arbitrators. And the contract at issue references the Zurich Chamber of Commerce, and that chamber has its own rules, and those rules have what they call a competence provision. Why isn't that the end of the matter?
In this instance, so the doctrine Your Honor is referring to is the delegation, what I'll refer to as the delegation doctrine under the Supreme Court's precedent, First Options v. Kaplan. It is the case that when parties clearly and unmistakably delegate the decision of arbitrability to the arbitrators, the district courts and the courts are to apply a highly deferential standard to the question of arbitrability. In this case, there is no clear and unmistakable evidence of an intent to delegate arbitrability. In the first case, there is no clear and unmistakable intent of evidence of an intent to arbitrate writ large, to submit the contract disputes to arbitration. So the very platform of arbitration is in question, much less the sub-question of a delegation to the arbitrators.
Just talk about the delegation. If you had expressly referenced the Swiss rules, that would be a clear enough statement to delegate the arbitrability question to the arbitrator.
I think there needs to be some caveating on that. If the question of arbitration is so,
we have a couple of cases where express reference to UNCITRAL rules is good enough because the UNCITRAL rules say the arbitrator determines arbitrability.
That's true. There's a number of cases.
You're just one step short of that. I mean, it may be a big step, but you're referencing the tribunal and the tribunal has its own rules.
Well, in this particular instance, there is no explicit reference to a set of arbitral rules that contain a competence rule within them. In particular, that's in the reference to this Chamber of Commerce of Zurich in this case is actually another level. It demonstrates a lack of clear and unmistakable intent on the delegation point, specifically because in 2004, I believe, the Zurich Chamber of Commerce integrated its rules with the Swiss Chamber's institution rules. So there was a new set of rules, and those rules are not explicitly referred to in this provision. So right away, there's an outdated reference, not to the rules, but to the institution itself. So the specific rules aren't referenced to, and the institution itself that is referenced to had displaced its previous rules with new set of rules anyway. So that compounds the level of ambiguity that we're dealing with here. And again, it's a very high standard for delegation. It's clear and unmistakable intent to delegate. And in First Options, the Supreme Court even cautioned that it was reversing the typical presumption in favor of arbitrability.
Is there any practice in the Zurich Chamber or Swiss Chambers or arbitration generally where the arbitrating authority has its own rules, but then they choose the party's contract for a different set of procedural rules?
I think there are instances that can be done. I mean, ad hoc arbitration operates in that fashion, in which the rule, there is no administration there's no administrating body. I think there is typically a problem when you select one institution to administer it, but then import the rules from some other institution. I don't think that works necessarily.
That seems odd.
That is odd, but that's not, I mean,
but then that binds you to the Zurich and Swiss rules, which have the competence provision.
That is not what happened here, however. I mean, the Zurich Chamber of Commerce integrated its rules with the with other chambers of commerce in Switzerland to form this aggregated Swiss chambers institution, what's called the Swiss rule. So it's not an instance of incompatible clauses, however, but it again does not rise to the clear and unmistakable intent to select some specific set of rules in that case. So that's on the delegation point. It's simply, and I just want to one more time emphasize that the Supreme Court in first options again noted that because the question of arbitrability implicates the foundational concept of consent to arbitration, it was imposing or flipping the typical presumption in favor of arbitrability to require a threshold of clear and unmistakable evidence of that.
What is your argument again about the BG Group Supreme Court case? Doesn't that stand in your way here? Because the arbitration dispute or the dispute section in the treaty that the court was interpreting had the same sort of requirement, and they called it a requirement to go to a local court. And the Supreme Court said that's just a precondition to arbitration, and whether that's been satisfied is up to the arbitrators, not the court.
Yes, so a few points, Your Honor. We don't think it's the same situation as BG Group. And that's when I wanted to begin with an understanding of the clause. That was in order to, that relates to both the merits of the question of the scope of arbitrability and because this court or the district court need to have a characterization, an understanding of the provision at issue. Is this a procedural precondition or what I'll call a mere procedural precondition, or is it a question of substance of arbitrability? So the difference is that under our interpretation of the contract, which we submit is the correct understanding of the arbitration clause, the requirement to go to local courts first is a mandatory requirement to submit breach of contract disputes under the contract to those local courts. The arbitration mechanism is a review of the disposition of those local courts' decision. So it's a different order of dispute resolution, which is done often in international arbitration under international legal standards of investor protections, like what's called denial of justice, to ensure that the local courts have treated an alien investor fairly under a minimum standard. So you have a breach of contract dispute being addressed at the local court level. The arbitration submission relates to the disposition of that dispute by the local courts to ensure a minimum standard of treatment. In the BG Group case, which the court found to be a procedural precondition, the submission of arbitration operates at a different level. So in BG Group, you have a treaty. The treaty contains a series of substantive investor protections, fair and equitable treatment, expropriation, and the like. So when the state does something that the investor objects to, there's some sort of policy or whatever, there's a ostensible breach of the treaty protection at the international legal level. So the delict is at the treaty level. The local litigation requirement in those treaties, and it's not always a requirement, that local litigation provision gives the state an opportunity essentially to redress that initial delict at the international level. So you have a treaty breach and the submission to local courts operates to give an opportunity to redress it at the local level. So if there was some provision in the law, the investor can challenge it in the local courts and through whichever mechanism exists there. But if that is either in the BG Group case, either if it's not done within 18 months or is simply not resolved to the investor's satisfaction, they can then bring the dispute to arbitration.
That's the point at which the Swiss tribunal said, and I mention it not because of any authority here, that's in doubt, but because of its empirical logic, that seems nonsensical. That is to say, you would have court jurisdiction, a final judgment. Of course, one party doesn't like it. And then you have another final judgment that is potentially contrary to the initial final judgment. I've never heard of any other system that operates that way. I don't see how it can operate. Well, the court said, the tribunal said, you have two final decisions out there. What happens?
That confusion on the Swiss tribunal's part was a function of its apprehension that in both cases you're submitting first instance breach of contract disputes to either local court. So it's
what's the counterindication to that?
If you look, and we think this is an incisive, highly probative piece of evidence, which was not apparently considered by the Swiss tribunal. If you look, for instance, to the foreign investment law of Equatorial Guinea, you'll find a remarkably similar dispute resolution mechanism where an investor is obligated to go to the local courts to exhaustion and then can take the dispute to international arbitration. And we submit that's precisely what was intended to be transposed essentially. And it's when you look at it through that prism of that foreign investment law and international legal obligations.
So what's the first step in that? It's not going to court.
It is going to court.
Oh, okay.
So it's a mandatory.
Again then.
Yeah, so you have a breach of contract dispute or a dispute arising out of, in the foreign investment law, it's whatever investment in this contract, it's the contract. That goes to the local court. It goes through the courts. If the investor has an issue, which they may or may not, they could have redressed sufficiently.
And it can be on the merits. They just don't like losing.
Right, but the standard of I don't want to use the phrase standard of review, but the breach at issue or what's being submitted to arbitration is not the breach of contract dispute itself, the first instance breach of contract dispute, but a review under international legal norms. So if there's a treaty, it would be under the treaty's provisions. Has there been an expropriation? Has there been a denial of fair and equitable treatment based on the disposition cumulatively of both the initial conduct and the disposition in the state courts? Or under, there's no treaty here we submit between Switzerland and Equatorial Guinea, but there's customary international law. In particular, there's the customary international legal protection called denial of justice, and in those cases, the court, there's no res judicata problem because it's a different standard, it's a different cause of action, it's
how,
a different.
How does that the provision, what is it, the investment that you, the Equatorial Guinea?
The foreign investment law.
Suppose there was no such dispute resolution clause in this contract, would that law then govern?
That would depend on whether this particular investment had been appropriately registered and acknowledged under the other provisions of that law. Certain investment, there's an approval process, et cetera, a gateway criteria. I don't know the answer to that. My understanding, I don't know if it's been registered appropriately. I don't believe it has, but I can't.
What was the basis for the arbitrator's decision to which I find rather strange, to credit the German translation of the Spanish provision rather than the Spanish provision itself? Translators, the authoritative version of whatever it is, a poem by Goethe or the Dead Sea Scrolls or whatever, but the original is the authentic, is the controlling provision, not the interpretation of it into another language.
So there's two points, and I'm sure my colleagues will have something to say about this, but the clauses are not necessarily a direct translation. It's a very puzzling contract in the sense that the Spanish and the German are side by side, and there's no, typically when you have that one, there's a designation that one language is prevailing over the other. That doesn't exist here. So the agreements were executed side by side in both languages. But we do maintain that the evidence suggests that the negotiations were dominated by Spanish because we see handwritten markups of the Spanish provisions, but not, that have changes
the
that are not
implemented. The signature was on the Spanish.
The signatures were also on
Before
the Spanish.
Before you run out of time, I have one question. This is a little bit off the subject we're talking about now, but it was this is the second arbitration.
Correct.
The first arbitration resulted in recovery, right?
Yes, there was a settlement agreement and payment.
And
yes.
Then, and that was paid by the country.
Yes, there was a settlement as to the exact amount.
So here's my question. The arbitrators here said, well, if you go to a court first, we're going to be bound under Swiss law by res judicata, right? Why aren't they bound by res judicata as a result of the first arbitration?
This is a function of, in my opinion, respectfully, an oddity of Swiss law, which I can't fully describe, which allows a piecemeal adjudication of certain claims.
But, so, but you haven't contested that.
No, not in this case. Not in this case. It was contested below. The Republic was of the view that the settlement should have disposed of all disputes that should have been effectively raised judicata of the entire dispute. But there is a provision under Swiss law that it's essentially a damages determination. It's,
but I guess my question is, in the first arbitration, there was no first resort to or a resort to the local courts. It went immediately into arbitration, right?
That, correct. There was no, and these issues were raised in that arbitration as well.
Is there a written decision?
In the there is. I don't have the first award in this case.
So I take it that means that Equatorial Guinea did not interpose this objection in the first arbitration.
It did, Your Honor. It did. In fact, that's the only.
It did not.
It did interpose this objection in the first arbitration.
And in the first arbitration.
Correct.
And then how was that resettled, did you say, or resolved?
Well, the tribunal exercised jurisdiction all the same. There's an interim decision, which I unfortunately don't have in the record. This was in 2011, and we haven't been able to obtain the award in that case. But there was an objection, and we, in fact, we only have the brief on jurisdiction with the Republic's objection in the first arbitration in this brief that's in this record. I believe that's at A353. That's the Republic's objections in the first arbitration. That was resolved against the Republic. There was an award. There was a settlement to finalize the amount at dispute. I think the management contract has a tables of damages, et cetera, and there was interest issues. There was a settlement that was paid. And in the same month that the settlement agreement was executed, Marseille Clinikin brought the second arbitration. And so then that was challenged. We can see from the award itself that there was a challenge on jurisdiction, both on the grounds that the settlement agreement should have predisposed of the dispute and because of the same, this interpretation of the clause.
Why isn't the interpretation you've offered one that makes resort to the Equatorial Guinea court a precondition precedent?
It is a condition, it is both a condition precedent, but it also determines the scope of what's ultimately arbitrable in that there's no arbitrable dispute until that occurs. So in essence, there is naturally a procedural element to it, but there is fundamentally a substantive scoping issue that arises only once the dispute is submitted to the local courts. And that's the fundamental distinction with BG.
So suppose there's a claim for a defense of latches with regard to several different elements of the dispute. That's a condition precedent, correct? I think that's listed by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that would be like right.
And
statute.
Then the resolution of those of the defense of latches might by picking and by eliminating some of the claims but not others determine the scope of arbitrability.
That's correct. But fundamentally, the dispute itself or the order of dispute would remain with respect to whatever was initially submitted to arbitration. Whereas here, there's the local remedy or the disposition of whatever is submitted in the first instance is what's being considered by the arbitral tribunal. So there's an entirely new element of how the initial claims are disposed of that isn't present in the latches situation. So it's helpful to consider, for instance, in the denial of justice standard, which we find the most illustrative of how this might work. That required, that's a whole new set of standards of conduct for whether or not there's been a denial of justice, for instance. So things like excessive delay in the proceedings or extreme procedural irregularities. And there's a robust dispute in the literature of, and some of the cases of whether gross substantive misapplications constitute. So there's a whole body of conduct that occurs essentially at the judiciary level in this instance, that is what would be submitted to arbitration as distinct from the contract dispute in the first place, which may be.
In what jurisdiction does this dispute arise? If we want to read ourselves into it, where would we look?
I'm sorry.
The dispute you just described about what constitutes procedural versus arbitrability.
That would be in, I'm not sure I'm following the question exactly, but the hypothetical
Is this a secondary literature or a bunch of court decisions or?
There is secondary literature and also it would be ICSID cases and other treaty cases typically is where this discussion takes place.
Can I take you back to BG?
Yes.
Everything you're saying about the difference between the underlying contract claim and the denial of justice claim makes sense to me. That's my understanding of how international law works as a default. But I mean, it's still the case that we have a Supreme Court decision. It frames a threshold question whether a local remedies rule, exhaustion rule, whatever you want to call it, gets a substance or procedure label, and the standard of review follows from that. And they say the right label is procedural. I don't see any difference between the provision at issue there and the provision at issue here. I mean, the Argentine court in BG could have decided the merits of the contract dispute. And then when you go to arbitration, presumably you'd be litigating denial of justice. I'm just not sure the clauses are different. What seems to be different, and I don't know if we can take account of this, but what seems to be different in the two cases is the underlying assumption of res judicata or not. The Supreme Court decided BG on the assumption that any local court decision in Argentina would have no res judicata effect. And the Swiss arbitrators here seem to think that a local court decision would have 100% full stop, you're done, res judicata effect. How do we take account of the underlying assumptions of res judicata when we're thinking about whether BG controls or not?
I think the res judicata, I don't know that the BG group actually discussed res judicata, but
I mean, Justice Breyer says the arbitral tribunal would not be required to give any particular weight to a local court decision, which seems very odd. I mean, it's not your denial of justice model.
So I think the res judicata problem that the Swiss court struggled with is a function of, at least in, I can talk about our res judicata standards, which require an identity in the cause of action of the dispute. In our instance, and in BG group, or in our instance, by which I mean our interpretation of the contract, there is no identity in cause of action between what's being submitted to the local court and what's being evaluated by the international tribunal.
Because the contract claim and the denial of justice claim.
And whatever international legal standard, it could
be
a treaty.
Is there a much simpler answer? I mean, number one, a res judicata can be waived. If you don't raise it, you've waived it. Number two, if your reading of the provision, the arbitration provision, is correct, the parties agreed to waive res judicata because they said the dispute that remains after the lower court decision is subject to arbitration.
That could be, Your Honor. That would depend on the substantive law of waiver and whether it's Switzerland.
Well, what law governs there? Is that Swiss law or is that United States law or is it Guinea law?
Well, we submit that the contract at this issue or the interpretation of the contract should have been under Equatorial Guinean law because it has the overwhelmingly closest nexus with the contract.
Under Guinea law?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But the Swiss arbitrators applied Swiss law as the seat of the arbitration.
Is there a statute of limitations for contract disputes in Equatorial Guinea?
I don't know the answer to that. I suspect there is, but
the reason I ask is if you prevail and they have to go to local court, they may wind up simply getting kicked out because of a statute of limitations problem.
If we prevail in this instance and they have to go to local court?
Yeah, but if the statute of limitations is run, then...
That may be, there may be some relation back.
They can then go to arbitration.
Well, they could then claim that they've been denied justice. That's right. And under our interpretation of the contract. But I want to, I'm well over my time, but I want to make sure I've addressed Judge Katz's your concern on res judicata. I think the res judicata conflict with the Swiss arbitrators were struggling with was a function of their interpretation that in both instances, you'd have breach of contract disputes being adjudicated at the first instance level.
One more question from me on a different subject. Does the Equatorial Guinea investment law govern this contract?
Judge Randolph asked me about the application of that law, and I think my answer has to be the same, which is I don't know whether this investment was properly registered under that law, and therefore whether it would.
I mean, it's a pretty significant question, right? If it governs, you win because the governing law says you have to go to the local court first, but it's a little unclear whether it is an option for investors to opt into and then you get certain benefits or whether it just covers the universe of all foreign investments.
There is a gateway threshold of that law, which requires certain approved investments and the like to qualify under that law. I don't know if, I don't believe this investment qualified, but to your point, Your Honor,
So the most we can do with the Guinea law of exhausting local remedies is it's a background assumption that people might have had in mind, even though it doesn't govern the contract directly.
I think it's a highly probative demonstration.
You're not arguing it's control.
Correct.
Okay.
The contract doesn't contain a choice of law provision?
No.
Okay. Implicitly, it does. The contract was executed in New Guinea or in Equatorial Guinea, and it's those courts of that country that, according to your view, get the first crack at this. So one would assume that they're going to be. And the contract was being performed in Equatorial Guinea.
Yeah, you're the overwhelming, again, it's a very puzzling decision by the Swiss courts, which it's a very puzzling election to apply Swiss law, given the extent that which Equatorial Guinean law is centered in this dispute. So with a sovereign for the administration of a state hospital performed and executed there.
However, in the BG case, the United States had no connection with that, with the parties or the performance at all. The only connection was that the arbitration took place here in Washington.
But in that case, I think the operative issue is that enforcement is being sought. So the substantive U.S. law on enforcement of awards is being applied.
Yeah.
The arbitration itself would be under the international law, specifically the UK-Argentina bid.
Okay. Thank you. We'll give
Thank you very much.
Mr. Schmidt.
Good morning, Your Honors. Paul Schmidt from DLA Piper on behalf of Marseille Clinicin AG, and I'll just refer to them as Marseille Clinicin going forward. This appeal concerns a garden variety foreign arbitral award that U.S. courts regularly confirm. A Applying relevant Supreme Court precedent, district court deferred to the arbitral tribunal's objective and reasonable interpretation of the arbitration clause that the parties had agreed to and which had also applied in a previous arbitration between these parties involving the same contract. Equatorial Guinea now comes to this court for relief, seeking to read into the clause the same non-existent and objectively unreasonable provisions it has previously argued for to the tribunal and the district court. Both the tribunal and the district court resoundingly rejected those arguments. After 7 years, it's time to bring this matter to closure, consistent with the clear policy favoring arbitration of disputes. Therefore, this court should affirm the district court's ruling. I want to start with the BG Group case. There was a lot of interest in that by the panel. And there's one fundamental problem with their theory about BG Group and how this clause is read, and that is that none of the provisions that they're arguing for, an appeal process or arbitration as appeal, some sort of limitation of appellate disputes and arbitration to denial of justice or miscarriage of justice, none of this is mentioned in the plain language of the clause. It's just simply not there. It's read into the clause by Equatorial Guinea.
Let's just start with BG Group.
Yes.
That case was decided on the assumption that an Argentine court decision would have no res judicata effect. So the only question, the court says, this is about when the case proceeds to arbitration, not whether a case proceeds to arbitration, right?
Yes.
This case has a different question. This case has a what question? Res judicata operates on the contract claim, and a different, quite the denial of justice question, the what question, gets submitted to the arbitrator. That's how international law normally works.
That is not in the plain language of the contract, Judge Kavanaugh.
Let's start with whether BG gets you, BG prevents us from reviewing the contract, Dano.
Right. I think the best way to answer that question, Judge Katz, is to look at what the Supreme Court said the controlling question was in that case. And that was, quote, who, court or arbitrator, bears primary responsibility for interpreting and applying the local litigation requirement to an underlying controversy. In our view, the matter is for the arbitrators. So it's not simply applying a clause that may have some sort of subset of disputes where a res judicata analysis would matter. It's a question of, is this on its face a procedural precondition? It is, clearly. The question then becomes, how is that interpreted?
You don't think the res judicata question matters?
I don't think it's relevant to the analysis. And so in BG Group, the court is very clear that what matters in terms of deference is the arbitrators get control over this question. And U.S. courts will defer to it because arbitrators know the procedural requirements of whatever the local rule is that's applying. And the court was clear that courts presume that parties intend arbitrators, not courts, to decide disputes about the meaning and application of particular procedural preconditions for the use of arbitration. And these issues are afforded considerable deference, which is exactly, by the way, what Judge Leon did. He applied the procedural precondition analysis. He found there was nothing to disturb the award, and he enforced it.
Suppose that the contract had said specifically that the contract matters were to be resolved initially in the Ghanaian court, federal Ghanaian court, and that thereafter any treaty issues could be resolved, or international law issues could be resolved in the tribunal. Would it still be a precondition, or is it only the ambiguity that introduces that possibility?
It's not ambiguity that introduces the possibility. I think this, which I have to say, Judge Ginsburg, just have to say, that's obviously not the circumstance we're facing here. But with regard to delegating particular issues for local courts in the arbitral tribunal, that is something which does happen in arbitration from time to time. But that's not the situation we're facing here. The tribunal, and I think we should look at what the tribunal did with the clause itself, with the arbitration clause itself, and how it interpreted it. There was a German and Spanish translation. The arbitral tribunal considered both of them, not one over the other, but both of them. That's in the award, paragraphs 131 to 149. And
would you repeat that? I didn't catch everything you just said.
Certainly, Judge Randolph. So we have to look at how the arbitral tribunal interpreted the clause in the first instance. And what the arbitral tribunal did was it looked at both the Spanish and German translations together as one contract, not as two separate things, but it attempted to reconcile between the two translations what the proper interpretation was. And doing that, it used objectively reasonable principles of Swiss law, which was the applicable law here because the seat of the tribunal was in Switzerland. And it found that under Swiss law principles, there was no reasonable way to read this contract in favor of what Equatorial Guinea says it means, because it doesn't mention appellate procedure.
Because you can't have a local decision followed by an international denial of justice adjudication, which is perfectly conventional international law.
Judge Katsas, it's not just a matter of denial of justice. The contract, the provision itself does not specify that the disputes are limited on appeal under their theory to denial of justice or miscarriage of justice.
It's a very confusing clause, and the arbitral tribunal did a great job saying you can read it one way, you can read it the other way. Dispute can refer to disagreement with the local court decision, or it can refer all the way back to the underlying contract.
There were two aspects of the tribunal's interpretation of this clause. The first is what you just mentioned, where it found there was some ambiguity in the contract with regard to how these provisions work either way.
And then it resolved the ambiguity by saying it just doesn't make sense to have a local adjudication followed by an international arbitration.
That's exactly right.
You might have some good arguments on reading of text, but that just doesn't seem to be, I don't get it. I mean, that's how international law works.
It was a little bit more than that, Judge Katsas. It said that, just bear with me for a second. The tribunal held that the arbitration as appeal interpretation was not reasonable because, one, it could result in two separately enforceable judgments. This implicates the res judicata issue, of course.
Right.
And an arbitration tribunal, also with regard to res judicata, should respect substantive res judicata regarding a previous decision and could not deviate from this. This was based on Swiss law, which found that state decisions, and this is the difference from the BG group, which you identified already. The Argentina case, I think, turned on the issue of what the Argentine government was doing at the time. It was limiting access to the courts. It was limiting the ability to pursue these claims with certain administrators.
And why should Swiss law?
Because it's the seat of the arbitration. And under Swiss law, the seat of the arbitration governs if the parties have not selected a forum law or a particular state's law in the contract. As you already identified previously, Judge Randolph, there was no choice of law clause here in the contract that said Equatorial Guinean law applies or...
Well, the idea that, as Judge Katz just pointed out, the idea that the reading that Equatorial Guinea puts forth would make no sense is belied by BG Group, because the statute or the treaty there provided exactly the same thing, that you go to the local courts and then you can go to arbitration. And you know, on top of that, there's the investment law that the counsel for the for Equatorial Guinea supplied. So where does this idea that it makes no sense come from?
Two things, Judge Randolph, responding to both your questions. First of all, it's interesting. BG Group ends up in exactly the same place that this case ends up, which is there is a provision, a local litigation requirement, which is a procedural precondition. It specifies that local litigation, and in that case, it really specified that there was local litigation required. Here, it does not do that. But procedural precondition was, they argue, local litigation first, then resort to arbitrators. In BG Group, the Supreme Court, in fact, deferred to the arbitral tribunal's determination that this was an unreasonable way to interpret the clause because the Argentine court system had been hindered in terms of access by investors to the court system. That's what happened here. The arbitral tribunal said, this is an unreasonable provision. We're going to read this provision, and we've determined that it's unreasonable in the way that it operates because of multiple awards, because it doesn't mention appeal, because all the trappings of an appeal, that language is not existent in the clause. So that's the first thing. The second thing was Equatorial Guinean law.
Wait, sorry, let me make sure I understand. In BG, there were very specific emergency measures that the Argentinian government enacted, which made it very burdensome for foreign investors to go to local courts. And that's what was held to be the excuse.
That's correct.
What is the analog here? What did the Equatorial Guinea court system or legislative system do to frustrate any ability to go to their local courts?
It's not a question of what the Equatorial Guinean system did. It's a question of
the question was, what did they do? And you should answer that first before you say why that's not the right question.
I apologize, Judge Randolph. I wasn't implying that something wasn't the right question. The issue in BG Group was the arbitral tribunal classified the reading that Argentina wanted to derive from the clause as unreasonable based on circumstances, which are obviously different from the circumstances here. Finding that the clause is unreasonable and the court deferring, our federal court system deferring to that determination, is the same thing that Judge Leon did. He deferred to a determination by the tribunal that the reading of the clause that they wanted to assign to it was objectively unreasonable.
But the basis for an unreasonable, the finding of excuse in BG was all of these emergency measures. The basis for the finding of unreasonability here is this idea that you must resolve textual ambiguity. What the arbitral tribunal said was textual ambiguity must be resolved in your favor because it just makes no sense to start in a local court and then go to international arbitration.
Well, that's where I was getting to the second part of their analysis, which was, okay, it looks at the text and says there's some ambiguity here on either side.
Right.
But we're going to use objective principles of contract interpretation under Swiss law and determine what is the most sensible version of this clause? What makes sense in terms of just general objectively reasonable principles? And it was under that analysis that the tribunal found that this clause that is at issue here did not provide for mandatory litigation in the local Equatorial Guinea court system. I want to address Judge Randolph's point before I lose sight of it, and that was, why should an Equatorial Guinean law apply to this contract? Arbitration is a matter of contract. The parties never contracted to Equatorial Guinean law applying. Counsel talked about the law on foreign investment and how provisions of the law on foreign investment are somehow relevant to the analysis here. It's interesting, the two provisions he identified, the mandatory recourse to Equatorial Guinean courts and exhaustion of local remedies, neither one of those is in the contract here. The parties could have easily put it in. Equatorial Guinea could have said, we're not entering into this contract until we have an exhaustion of remedies provision, and until the contract says, clearly, you're going first for all disputes to Equatorial Guinean courts, and then you can have arbitration. That clause does not say that at all. It doesn't mention an exhaustion of remedies issue, and there's no proof, and to my knowledge, they were not investors under the statute, but certainly there's nothing they can point to show that they were investors under the statute, or that this statute controls. I think Judge Katsas, you already addressed that.
Well, I think
that argument is, it's like the argument we see once in a while that Congress knows how to say such and so, and they didn't say it. Because there's another side to that argument. The other side is that your client never put in that those laws do not apply. And the reason we have a dispute here in part is because neither side did anything to clarify the point.
Well,
I don't think there's much mileage you get from that point.
So there is one thing that's clear, Judge Randolph, and that is that the parties said that any arbitration, regardless of whether you accept their interpretation or our interpretation, any arbitration would take place before the Chamber of Commerce of Zurich. And the Chamber of Commerce of Zurich is going to apply Swiss law because it's at the seat, unless the parties have obviously contracted otherwise. They did not. So the contract itself has a strong suggestion that Swiss law applies. And the Zurich Chamber of Commerce at the time of the arbitration, at the time the management agreement was signed, followed the Swiss rules. That is not in dispute at all. And both versions of the Swiss rules.
I want to just follow up on one question in your reading. Well, it's not your reading, but one of the things that occurred to me, I don't have it in front of me, these two clauses, is that, and Judge Cass has mentioned this, is that the nature of the dispute that can be arbitrated is different than the original dispute. Because under the reading, I think either clause says that if a dispute occurs, the German, or if a disagreement results, the Spanish version, that is what gets arbitrated. And what gets arbitrated is not the original dispute, because the court may have settled part of that to the satisfaction of the parties. It's only what remains after by one party or both of what the court decides that is subject to arbitration.
That's not our understanding of what the clause says, Judge.
Well, obviously. Yeah.
I want to pull out the language of the clause to make sure I'm quoting it properly.
The German uses disputes occur, and the Spanish says disagreement after the court decides.
You're referring to the second sentence of the clause, correct, Judge Randolph, where it's setting up the
arbitration? I'm not looking at what page is that?
German.
It's
German uses the word disputes twice in both sentences.
One in singular and one in plural, I believe.
And the Spanish uses disputes in the first sentence and disagreement second, is my understanding.
I just want to say at the outset, I'm going to answer your question, Judge Randolph. I just want to say at the outset that because this is a procedural precondition, deference must be given to the arbitrator's interpretation. But with that said and on the table.
Let's assume we want to construe it. I know you have arguments against that.
Yeah. I'll read, first of all, the tribunal's interpretation of the German version subsequently translated into English. The second sentence says, in the event of a dispute, the parties agree to seek arbitration proceedings before the Chamber of Commerce in Zurich. That language,
what are you reading it from?
This is JA-72 from the award. I can read you Judge Leon's version as well. He has a slightly different version. It's essentially the same thing, JA-598. He took it from the management agreement. I'll read that provision.
JA what?
598. I'll read that provision because it's in Judge Leon's version. It's clearly in the record. If disputes do occur, the parties shall commit to arbitration proceedings before the Chamber of Commerce in Zurich. That language does not say anything about disputes about some judgment from Equatorial Guinean courts. The previous sentence is setting up, first of all, the first step, which is you're going to try to settle this amicably. That is the only mandatory language here in the first sentence. And then you're going to do that before you make any attempt to call on the courts of Equatorial Guinea. Calling upon the courts of Equatorial Guinea is exactly what disputes or disagreement, depending on if you're looking at the Spanish version.
May I interrupt you? On the page 8 of the Equatorial Guinea brief, right? There's the English translation of the German translation, right? You refer to the English translation of the German translation on page 598 of Judge Leon's opinion.
That's correct.
They're different.
They are.
Which is right?
Well, that's a good question, Judge Randolph. So for purposes of the record,
I hadn't noticed this, but Judge Leon's statement of that clause is different from the statement at Appendix 263.
If you'll bear with me for a second, Judge Randolph, I'm going to look at their brief to make sure I'm certain about. So A263, I believe those are the exhibits that they attached to the district court record.
Yeah, Judge Leon's recitation appears to be incorrect.
Well, Judge Leon is taking it from the management contract, the management agreement. the English version of the management agreement. So the reason all this gets, I don't want to use the word confused, but it's the first thing that comes to mind. There's obviously the original clause that the tribunal sets out in its award. There's there's the translated version of that into English, which was furnished for purposes of the record in this case. I believe Equatorial Guinea provided their own translations of these clauses. And Judge Leon looked at the translation of the management agreement, which is a separate document, so not the award, but a separate document in the record that's translated from German and Spanish into English.
Let me ask you, are the parties in agreement that, like, with respect to the accuracy of the translation into English?
We do not agree with their Spanish language version into English. I can't speak for them, Your Honor. I don't know if they have.
So you don't agree with Equatorial Guinea's statement on page, what is it? Is it page 7 of the brief? Is that right?
I'm looking at their brief. You're referring to the one in the box, right? Right here on page 7.
I have in my notes that the arbitrators rejected the translation at 263.
Right. They noted that they found it not accurate. They found that translation not accurate. They didn't explain why or parse it, but they found that to be not accurate.
It seemed to me not hugely different. But in any event, are you okay with us using the translations that the arbitral tribunal put forth?
Yes.
Okay. And is that what the district court used?
The district court took it from the management agreement, the translated management agreement in the record. So we submitted as part of our petition to confirm the contract containing the arbitration clause, as we were supposed to do under the foreign sovereign.
Does it matter to you which of these two?
Excuse me?
Does it matter which of these two, management agreement translation or the contract interpretation into German, we rely on?
To answer your question directly, it does not matter. And in fact, expanding outward, it doesn't matter what version of this clause translation you look at. It's the same result. And that is, and to return to the point I was making, the language that Your Honors had highlighted in the event of a dispute, that is referring to the last clause in the previous sentence. That's how typically we construe context in terms of interpretation. Prior to calling upon the courts of Equatorial Guinea, it doesn't say resolution in the courts of Equatorial Guinea. It doesn't say exhaustion of remedies. It just simply says prior to calling on those courts. And in the event of a dispute with regard to, this is where you have to take context, in the event of a dispute with regard to that decision to go to the Ghanaian courts, the parties agree to seek arbitration proceedings in the Chamber of Commerce of Zurich. That's exactly what happened here. Marseille Clinicin did not want to pursue its claims in the Equatorial Guinean courts, and it took them to arbitration just as the parties contracted for. The plain language of the text of the clause supports that interpretation.
Disputes in the first sentence refers to the underlying contract dispute.
Yeah, any dispute arising from the contract, the typical all-inclusive.
Dispute in the second sentence refers neither to that nor to disagreement with a decision of the local court. It's a dispute about invoking the local court's jurisdiction.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
It's a very odd.
Well, putting aside how you parse the language, as you identified, the tribunal had some difficulty with it. They applied interpretations of contracts through Swiss law and found that this was the most reasonable translation. It was more reasonable to read the version which they approved of, which is that there's a trumping mechanism for arbitration over Equatorial Guinean courts in this clause, as opposed to what the other side is arguing for, which is to argue all this language about limitation of claims, exhaustion of remedies, appeals. None of this, none of it is in the clause itself.
So you think, sorry, go ahead.
Can race judicata be waived under Swiss law?
I honestly don't know, Judge Randolph. What I do know is that Swiss law says that judgments of a state court, meaning state in the terms of a country, judgments of a state court take precedence over arbitral judgments. That's the order of
unless
public
language. Unless the parties decide otherwise.
Unless the parties decide otherwise, which they did not do in this case.
Well, that's an open question.
There's certainly no explicit language in the contract to support that interpretation, Judge Randolph, and they haven't pointed to anything to suggest that it would.
So I had thought one textual point cutting against you was that your interpretation would make this reference to calling on the local courts or turning to the local courts just nonsensical. And you're saying, no, the work it does is it gives either party the option of going to local court, and then it gives the counterparty an override.
That's correct. So if Equatorial Guinea had, and I don't think there's anything in the record to support this scenario, but if Equatorial Guinea had filed a lawsuit in Equatoguinean courts, the contract says that we would have the right to take that to arbitration instead. That's how it works. So it's a trumping mechanism, essentially.
What about they try to invoke local law to support their interpretation? They also try to invoke Swiss law. And the Swiss cases they cite maybe stand for the proposition that if an arbitration clause provides for a choice, one can either go to an arbitral tribunal or to a court. That is an insufficiently clear commitment to arbitration to be imposed on an unwilling defendant.
That's certainly how they categorize those cases, Judge Katsas. It's not what those cases actually say.
What do you think they say?
So there's three cases that they cite. The first one is just general principles.
One seems to say if you have a choice, that's not good enough. And the second one and the third one seems to say if the provisions are conflicting, not enforceable.
That's right. So, and unfortunately, the Swiss...
Overreading.
Unfortunately, the Swiss system doesn't have tidy named cases like we do. They have these long numbers.
But which is why I said the second and the third.
Yeah. So in case 4A279 from 2010,
okay,
the contract provided that, quote, the parties agree in advance to have the dispute submitted to binding arbitration through the AAA,
right,
or to any other U.S. court. Now, that is a clear ambiguity. It's unclear what's being chosen here.
Ambiguity?
Fair enough, Judge Randolph. Point taken, touche.
Why isn't that effectively saying the parties may go to arbitration or may go to a U.S. court?
Because it doesn't exclude one at the expense of the other, which is what this clause does. This clause says you can go to the Equatorial Guinean courts, but if one party says arbitration, you're going to arbitration. This clause says you can do one or the other. It doesn't say if one has precedent over the other. It doesn't provide the mechanism that this clause does. So that's that case. That's the 4A279 case. The 4A244 case in 2012, the third case they mentioned, the clause provided that the dispute would be submitted exclusively to arbitration in Lausanne, Switzerland. But a separate governing law clause in the contract stated that each of the parties hereto submits to the non-exclusive jurisdiction of the Swiss courts. It's unclear which court you're supposed to go to there. One court in Lausanne or any court in Switzerland. Again, does not have the same veto mechanism that this clause does in this case.
Want to wrap up? I'll give you a couple of sentences.
I just want to touch on the clear and unmistakable evidence point.
I'm sorry?
The clear and unmistakable deference point. It was mentioned at the outset of the question. Yeah. So when there's no dispute here that when rules are incorporated.
They incorporated the tribunal, but not the rules.
Right. So.
And the rules, if I have them right, say these rules, I assume is the Swiss arbitral rules, shall govern where an agreement to arbitrate refers to these rules, which means if there's no reference to the rules and we're in contractual arbitration, the parties might or might not agree to all of the procedural rules.
Well, there's some history, but I'm going to answer that question in a second. I want to give the history behind it first.
All right.
They had the opportunity to object to the application of the Swiss rules. There was procedural order number one, this is all in the brief, but procedural order number one, the tribunal put essentially in flashing red lights that, hey, the Swiss rules are going to apply. They drafted procedural order number one and circulated a draft to the parties. They didn't object. There was an organizational meeting that discussed this very issue. They didn't object. And there's no dispute that section 21.1 of the Swiss rules do provide the arbitrator competence to determine their own competence. So one, they waived this issue by not raising it before the arbitral tribunal. That's the Dorlay case, which was just decided 2 months ago, which says that if you don't raise a defense in arbitration, it's waived later enforcement.
And on the merits?
On the merits, there's the issue of which rules applied, or the Zurich Chamber of Commerce, which rules they apply. The Zurich Chamber of Commerce uses the Swiss rules. They have sophisticated counsel who should have been aware of this when the forum was chosen. It used this, it incorporated the Swiss rules in 2004, I believe. It set up the Swiss Chambers Arbitration Institute, which is—
Do you have any sense of how common it might or might not be for an arbitral body to use different rules? I mean, I had thought one follows from the other inexorably. I mean, you know, if you agree to an adjudication in the district court for the District of Columbia, you get our local rules, period, full stop.
Right.
But I just don't know if arbitration has that inexorable.
I can't answer your question and say that it never happens, Judge Katsas, because I don't know that for a certainty. I will agree it's very unusual, and I've never seen it in my career, 14 years practicing.
Okay. Anything else?
I think I've covered all my points. So I just want to thank the court. We would ask that you affirm Judge Leon's decision to enforce this arbitral award against the against Guinea. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Havlock, I'll give you a couple minutes.
Thank you. Just a couple of points in order. There was a remark about what the Swiss arbitral law requires and how it requires the application of the law of the seat of the tribunal, the seat of the tribunal, i.e. Swiss law. I would just direct the court to some briefing in the arbitration, the first arbitration at A362, which cites the A362, which cites the Swiss Public International Law Act, provision 187.1, and the Swiss rules themselves at 33.1, which also enables the application of the law with the closest connection with the dispute, which in this case we submit is the law of Equatorial Guinea. I want to then focus, hopefully most of my time, on the contract itself, and there was discussion about translations and interpretations.
Yeah, so why can't, just to cut to the chase, why can't the word disputes in the second sentence of the German translation or disagreement in the second sentence of the Spanish translation refer to a decision to go to the local court? Not the underlying contract dispute and not the decision, the local court decision on the back end.
So I think the answer to that question lies in the first sentence in either language. And if I may make one clarification point, there was a mention of the Republic's translation being rejected by the tribunal. And I think the discussion was around the translation.
Are you okay if we just use the translations from the arbitral award?
I don't think there's, I think so. So
and I just see any material difference.
Yeah, there. I don't, so the translation at A263 was a certified translation submitted by us in the district court.
Rejected.
That was not rejected by anybody as far as I know. So that, I just want to make that clear. That was what was only introduced in the district court, not considered by the tribunal at all. So that's been I don't think there's any dispute. And I generally don't think that as between the various iterations of German to English and the various iterations of Spanish to English, there's any meaningful difference. The differences are between the German and
the
Spanish.
What's the answer?
Okay, so in the Spanish, focusing on the Spanish for a moment, the first sentence refers to, uses the word litigio to refer to disputes, which are legal disputes. The German uses...
About the underlying contract.
Yes, a legal dispute is implicated. In the German, it uses the word for disputes in both sentences. That's Streitigkeit. But in the first sentence, it goes on and specifically says, Streitigkeiten aus diesem Vertrag, which is dispute arising from this agreement, contract dispute. Mm-hmm. The Spanish then uses mandatory verbs with respect to both amicable dispute resolution and mandatory verbs with respect to...
Will attempt conciliation, otherwise will turn to local.
Correct, correct.
Okay.
So we start with that first sentence, and there's no disparity between the German and the Spanish on those two points. The
German is a little bit ambiguous on whether the shall covers the attempt to conciliate. It covers that at a minimum, and then it may or may not project forward to calling on the local courts. Just reading the English words, I thought that was ambiguous.
That's right. So we submit that the Spanish contains one tier of ambiguity, which is how the two sentences interact. The German contains two tiers of ambiguity, how the sentences interact.
On this point, you say Spanish is clear, two levels of mandatory. German is ambiguous. We harmonize with the Spanish.
Correct. Correct. And so, but we start from that basic issue that the first sentence uses mandatory language to refer to quite clearly for this contract disputes are going to local courts. Then we get a disagreement about what the word disagreement or disputes means in the second sentence in either language. I think with a view of what we just read in the first sentence, if you adopt our interpretation, every single word in every language is given its ordinary meaning. Effect is given to its ordinary meaning. Whereas in the tribunal's interpretation, it disregards the use of mandatory words for contract disputes being submitted to local courts. And here then,
unless you think calling upon or turning to local courts is its own thing, separate from any decision they might render.
Turning to arbitration, I think you mean?
No, I had thought calling on the local court. Well, I don't know. I guess your point is calling upon the local court is a futile gesture if the mechanism is either party can just go straight to arbitration.
That's right. And here we enter the discussion of
might not be a nullity, but it's an oddity.
I think it's pathological. It would be that interpretation would be pathological under the Swiss and in what we'll call the third case that we cite, which is which has 2012 in the title, XVY 2012, we'll call it. To counsel's point, the submission to the Swiss courts in that employment agreement was non-exclusive. The submission to arbitration was exclusive. I don't see the difference between that scenario and the one here, which gives the court, which gives the claimant the option of going to local court, the state courts of Switzerland in that case, or what, as the court found, has left open recourse to the state courts, but has not excluded clearly jurisdiction of the local courts. And we think that should be dispositive on that point.
Mr. Randolph? Yeah. Anything?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.